there, I'm Kim Vanell. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, he's a prolific tweeter, and Elon Musk is set to become Twitter's owner in a $44 billion deal. So what will the world's richest man gain? And how is the influential platform likely to change? Also this week, mountains of debt in the world's poorest nations. The IMF and World Bank warn many countries are at risk of distress. They're calling for urgent action. So who should foot the bill? Nepal's dwindling foreign currency reserves. The government limits imports and turns to citizens abroad to shore up its cash stockpile. Is the Himalayan nation heading for an economic crisis? It's been a volatile deal, and if it goes through, it would be one of the largest leveraged buyouts on record. Tesla and SpaceX CEO Elon Musk has agreed to acquire Twitter for $44 billion. That could potentially add a new job to his resume, a new age media baron, given millions of users rely on Twitter for their news. And they might get some of the platform's content restrictions relaxed. Musk says he wants to promote free speech, but what does that mean in practice? Gabriel Elizondo reports from New York.
The deal is done. The month-long saga of who will own Twitter appears over. In one of the largest and most unusual tech acquisitions ever, the board of directors at Twitter unanimously agreed to sell the social media company to Elon Musk for $44 billion. Up until the deal was announced, there was doubt on Wall Street that Musk could cobble together the financing needed, but he did. Musk helped pay for the deal with $25.5 billion in debt financing by a group of banks led by Morgan Stanley. In a press release announcing the deal, Musk talked about improving the platform by getting rid of automated spam accounts and making its algorithms open to the public and authenticating all users. But for Musk, buying Twitter is about free speech, or at least his version of it, potentially ending Twitter's current content moderation or stopping deplatforming of users who break the rules.
Elon Musk is not buying Twitter for financial reasons, although he thinks he can make some money on it. He's buying it for ideological reasons. And I think that's the really important part in all this. And that's ultimately what's scary.
With Musk in control, they fear a return to the unruly spread of disinformation on the platform. So is today a good day or bad day for Twitter users?
That is probably the most important question here. And I think it's also the question that's going to be hardest to answer. I think that if he undoes a lot of the work that has been done trying to protect against sort of normatively bad speech, such as misinformation and especially hate speech, that's going to be a bad day for Twitter users. But, you know, there's a chance that he takes over and doesn't sort of have quite as sweeping of a reform agenda as he's put forth over the last couple of weeks.
It's been a tumultuous month for Twitter that saw Musk take a 9% stake in the company, making him its largest shareholder. He was then offered a seat on the board of directors, only to have it abruptly revoked, followed by his cash offer to buy the entire company, all within the last few weeks. Ultimately, Elon Musk got what he wanted, to not only be a Twitter user, but to also be its owner. Gabriel Elizondo, Al Jazeera, New York.
But investors have long been concerned about the company's growth. The numbers suggest that Twitter is hardly the most successful social media platform in the marketplace. The company ended 2021 with a $5 billion revenue, a fraction of the figures recorded by other platforms. Facebook's core app earned nearly $70 billion in advertising revenue, more than 15 times the amount Twitter earned in the same period last year. Twitter is not the biggest social platform either. It has more than 217 million daily users, compared with billions for Facebook and Instagram. Well, there have been different reactions to the deal from politicians. While the White House said it's concerned about the power of large social media platforms, some Republicans welcomed it as an encouraging day for freedom of speech. To discuss all of that now, I'm joined by Daniel Ives from New York. Daniel is the Managing Director and Senior Equity Research Analyst at Wedbush Securities. Thank you for your time. Are you surprised by this deal?
Look, I thought no one in a million years coming in 2022 would think that Elon Musk would own Twitter. So with that said, look, Twitter is vulnerable. I mean, the company's been underperforming social media for the last decade, and Musk knew that there was an opportunity. And ultimately, it was a Game of Thrones. The board looked for another bidder, a white knight, couldn't find it. Musk detailed his financing, richest person in the world. They had to sit down, deal got done. So, you know, look, I think for Musk, the easy part, he was playing chess. The board was playing checkers. So that was the easy part. The hard part is going to be fixing Twitter, which is what I view as almost an Everest-like uphill battle.
There's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing to get to this point. It was, you know, is Elon Musk going to join the board? No, he's not. He wants to buy it out. They're going to put forward this poison pill plan. That didn't happen. Why do you think it is that the board ended up accepting this deal?
Look, this was a Game of Thrones, right, in terms of how it all played out. I mean, ultimately, I think Musk surprised the board with the 9% stake. They tried to invite him on, thinking Musk is just going to eat cheese and crackers in the corner and approving board measures. But we all know that's not Musk. So once Musk decided not to join the board, that's where this became hostile. Now, of course, the board did a poison pill, and that just gave them time to try to find a second bidder. But Musk's price for Twitter, there's no one in the universe that would match that. So that continued to play out, and ultimately, their options started to diminish, and they were at a point where they had to accept the bid for Musk. And that's why we are where we are, because there were really no other white knights.
Elon Musk says this isn't about money. He's described himself as a free speech absolutist. How do you think he is going to change Twitter? He's talked about obviously making the algorithm open source. Beyond that, what sort of changes do you think we're going to see?
It look, likely goes to a subscription model, you know, probably per month in terms of what it's paid. In terms of the freedom of speech issue, look, it's a firestorms issue. You know, I mean, how, you know, ultimately do you make sure it's not accessible, you know, which it has become over the years? And then how do you monetize it? Because remember, he's spending 20% of his net worth. So saying freedom of speech is one thing. He just basically took a decent piece of his Tesla shares and trade that for Twitter. And I think now, I mean, they're going to have to, okay, subscription model, you know, less constriction in terms of what you could say. But does that ultimately improve it from a monetization perspective? Because they've been losing out to TikTok, Instagram, Facebook in this social media arms race, which continues to bleed. That's why, you know, in terms of Musk trading in his Tesla for Twitter shares, that just puts more pressure on Tesla stock, and you've seen that play out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he said this is, I guess, it's about his ideals and his thoughts on free speech. There are concerns in some quarters that this could just kind of inflame misinformation, that we're going to see even more misinformation, that, as you put it, it's going to become even more of a cesspit. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, the problem with Twitter is that we could talk about Twitter from Trump to all the other controversies, but yet they're a third-tier player in social media. So you never hear TikTok or Instagram, yet the amount of users are 10x. And I think that's the problem, is that, you know, the balancing act to make sure Twitter doesn't go down that path, that's going to be difficult. And then how do you do and monetize it? That's why it continues to be. This was a major head scratcher for Musk to go in terms of going after Twitter. It's a different animal than PayPal, Tesla, SpaceX, his obviously just massive, massive historic success stories. And I think that's the problem going forward. The other issue is that it's political blowback, not just in the U.S., but just globally on both sides of the aisle. And now could that have an impact on Tesla, SpaceX? And that's really been the concern, especially for sort of a company like Tesla and SpaceX, where Musk is the hearts and lungs of those companies.
Do you think that regulators could step in and stop the deal? Or how do you think Twitter will react to regulations in general?
Look, I think from an antitrust perspective, it won't get blocked because there's really no antitrust issues. I do think there'll be twists and turns, both in Brussels as well as the Beltway. probably a lot of sort of regulatory scrutiny because it's such an important platform in terms of global reach. But if you look at Twitter stock right now, I still think there's, we'll call it 10 to 15% uncertainty in terms of what Wall Street's baking in that the deal ultimately does not get done. Look, Musk, the breakup fee, basically if he decides to walk away, it's $1 billion. That's pretty small relative to a deal of this size. So that's just something to watch out for, not just the regulatory, but some of the other issues that could get in the way here. And as we all know, Musk, 24 hours could change his tune.
As you say, Twitter has not performed in the way that the other big social networks have. Why is that? And do you think Elon Musk could bring, I guess, the Elon Musk factor to Twitter and make it profitable?
To that point, PayPal, Tesla, SpaceX, right? I mean, we're talking some of the biggest success stories basically of the last 50 years and maybe ever, especially when it comes to Tesla and SpaceX. But Twitter's a different animal. Okay, to monetize it, you can make it a paid subscription service. The problem with Twitter has just been engagement has not been there. As we talked about, it starts to become just a cesspool in terms of from a hate perspective. And now it's kind of, okay, like what could he do to turn this around? There is a Musk factor. You could see more come on the platform. But then you could also see, depending on which way he takes it, some leave the platform. And I think that really continues to be the conundrum for Musk, because he just spent $44 billion, and that's a lot to spend in terms of pushing free speech, especially when it comes to a Twitter platform where that's easier said than done, especially as we've seen over the last few years.
Absolutely. Hey, thank you very much for your time. We'll leave it there. From New York, Daniel Ives.
Thank you.
Oil prices are surging around the world, and as central banks raise interest rates to tame inflation, borrowing is becoming more expensive. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund say that's putting more pressure on the poorest nations, who face what they say is a huge buildup of debt. At least a dozen countries might not be able to pay back billions of dollars owed to lenders over the next year. The world's financial institutions are calling for urgent action to find solutions. At least 74 low-income nations will have to repay an estimated $35 billion to official bilateral and private sector lenders this year. Government debts in low-income countries are expected to exceed 50% of gross domestic product, up from less than 44% in 2019 before the pandemic started. Almost 60% of all low-income countries are in or near debt distress, which means they need to restructure their debts or are at risk of needing to do so. And debt repayments are estimated to be up 45% in just the last 2 years. The IMF says China's share of external debts owed by the 73 highly indebted poor nations jumped to 18% in 2020 from 2% in 2006. Poor nations will pay China and its lenders almost $14 billion this year in debt servicing costs, while the private sector lending rose to 11% from 3%. And the combined share of multilateral institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank and the Paris Club lenders of mostly rich Western governments fell to 58% from 83%. Campaigners are calling for debt payments of developing countries to be dropped this year. Almost 50 countries must resume paying back after a G20 initiative, which provided less than $13 billion in debt suspension, expired last year. The G20 later launched the Common Framework for Debt Treatments, but only Zambia, Ethiopia and Chad applied for it so far, and progress on restructuring their debts has been slow. Well, Greg Swenson joins us now from London. Greg is the founding partner at merchant bank Brigg Macadam. Thank you very much for your time. So a huge buildup of debt, a credit crunch and borrowing costs are rising. How bad is the debt crisis going to get?
I think it will get a lot worse before it gets better, Kim. Look, you've had a massive buildup of sovereign debt not just over the last 2 years because of the COVID crisis, but really after the last 14 years since the global financial crisis in 2008, as balance sheets have shifted from the consumer to some degree to corporates, but more importantly from the consumer and corporate balance sheets, including banks, to the sovereigns, to government debt. So this is unsustainable, and I think we'll see a lot of potential difficulties in the next couple of years.
We're talking today about poor countries. They're not well equipped. They don't have huge reserves. How are they going to manage this debt, especially as it's getting more expensive to service?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, Kim. And obviously, they have to restructure it. They have to work it out. That's not necessarily a great long-term solution, but it's a near-term solution. It's not like they're defaulting or they're just piling on more debt. I think just refinancing is a mistake because it doesn't solve the problem. It's just extending the obligation and, if anything, adding more interest and obligation to the loan. So I think it's important that they restructure, they work with the global DFIs and the multilateral institutions to work out and restructure these loans. Otherwise, things will get a lot worse before they get better, especially for the poor countries who can't just print money from their central banks, like especially the U.S., but also many of the Western central banks.
If we accept then that we're in a debt crisis, who's responsible for that crisis? Is it the lenders or is it the borrowers?
That's a tricky one. I mean, look, it's really both. You know, borrowers are going to take the money, especially developing countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, as well as Eastern Europe. You know, they will take the money if offered. And one of the results of money printing over the last decade of quantitative easing and zero interest rates is that too much money is chasing too few assets. So financial assets have been pushed up. The percentage of financial asset valuation compared to GDP has changed dramatically. And so they have to, the lenders in a way have to reach out to the developing countries to get any type of yield. And the developing countries are sometimes foolish to take the money and fall into a debt trap. It's really, you know, I think both borrower and lender are to blame. And this is what happens when there's too much money chasing too few assets.
There are some debt relief mechanisms. How effective do you think they've been?
Well, in many cases, they're very effective, Kim, and especially in the near term. You know, some of these developing countries are just running through a near-term challenge, for example, overborrowing during the COVID crisis. Those were not necessarily issues that they brought upon themselves. Those aren't long-term structural defects with their economies. That was just a short-term problem brought upon, you know, created by the COVID crisis and many of the Western governments shutting down their own economies, but also encouraging the developing economies to shut down as well. So look, I don't think that's something that's a long-term defect. So those type of restructurings in the near term are very important to the developing countries and important to the lenders who need to restructure or work out these loans. But I think in the long term, there has to be a shift from the aid and sovereign debt model to more of a long-term investment model. That means private capital and the global development financial institutions investing in infrastructure and critical imports for these countries. So it's not just loans and aid that need to be reworked. It's long-term impact and opportunity from the lenders.
All right. From London, Greg Swenson, thank you.
Thanks, Kim.
Nepal has been struggling with a loss of tourists, a fall in remittances and a trade deficit. But while visitors are starting to trickle back in, its economic problems are expected to get worse. Fuel and food prices are skyrocketing and the Himalayan nation is running low on foreign currency and could even run out in less than 7 months. Ramyata Limbu reports now on how the government is trying to shore up its stockpiles of cash.
In this bustling market in downtown Kathmandu, it's business as usual. But experts warn behind all the activity, an economic crisis is looming. During the pandemic, the number of tourists fell. The amount of money sent home by Nepalese working abroad also dropped significantly.
Nepal's international debt isn't particularly high, but as ballooning imports and high oil prices deplete its foreign currency reserves, experts warn the country could be headed towards an economic crisis if the government doesn't step up in time.
And there are other pressures.
There's been a hike in oil prices. A litre of petrol that cost around 100 rupees now costs 160 rupees.
Nepal's central bank has taken action to manage imports and increase foreign exchange reserves.
That's some kind of the challenge in the economy, particularly because of the import of some of the items, for example, the vehicles or the petroleum products, which account large portion of the import in Nepal. So how we can manage that? That's one of the issues that is struggling in the present context.
Ritu Singh Baidya imports cars and heavy-duty equipment to Nepal. She says it's important for businesses to work with the government, the central bank and business community.
We being a completely import-oriented economy, we have a huge trade imbalance because we have nothing being exported from here, or at least very little being exported from here. So every small change in the world or in the globe impacts us. And that is why we have these, these panic situations every now and then.
As Nepal absorbs economic shocks, experts say it needs to act fast to avoid a full-blown crisis.
Well, from Kathmandu, I'm joined now by Biswas Kalchand, the Executive Director of the Kathmandu-based Institute for Integrated Development Studies. Thank you very much for joining us. So let's start with putting it simply. Is Nepal on course for an economic crisis?
Not at all. We are nowhere near an economic crisis in Nepal. We are feeling some pressure on external sector balance, but it doesn't mean that we are facing an economic crisis.
Nepal is running out of foreign currency reserves, though. Those reserves fell by more than 16% just in the past few months. Why is that, and how low are they against the country's debt?
What happened was, after COVID, two economic activities quickly recovered. The one is bank credit, and then import. So this led to some pressure on our external reserve balances. So our main problem is on the terms of trade, unlike in Sri Lanka, where the problem is more on the external debt. Ours is more on the terms of trade, because we have been facing a very large trade deficit for the last 5 years. And our current account deficit is growing every year. So that's where some measures have to be done to check the negative consequences.
Let's talk about remittances. They constitute nearly a third of the Nepalese economy. The government says if 100,000 Nepalese nationals living abroad each deposited $10,000 into Nepalese banks, that could help overcome the crisis. I mean, how realistic is that, though?
Actually, in recent years, our remittance as a percentage of GDP has come down to around 22% or so from the highs of 26% a few years back. But that itself is significant, revenue for the country. So among various measures that government wants to implement, one of the new measures that taken by the government is to tap the savings of Nepali diaspora living in advanced countries. In order to attract them, government or the banking institutions have started giving a very attractive interest rate, both in dollar deposit as well as local currency deposit. So that has started attracting Nepali diaspora living in advanced countries. And that is among many measures that government would like to take in future, but that will help, at least in the short term, that's going to help us to, have a better cover for our imports.
Yeah, let's talk about that. The reserves, as you said, are less enough for less than 7 months. So how is the limit on non-essential imports? How is that going to help? How much is that going to help?
The government of Nepal has introduced measures to ban 10 items of import. And a few months back, the central bank has tightened the credit for import. And these together have, started making some impacts in terms of imports. But there is always a room for, private sector, the importers to find a ways to, import goods. But I think this is one of the major measures that government has to take because immediately. There's no other ways rather than to, you know, put restrictions on imports, because these are the immediate measures that the government can take. For in the long run, we need to initiate lots of structural reforms to address this issue. Mm-hmm. But in immediate terms, I think putting restrictions on import is the only way that a government can do.
All right. Thank you very much for your time, Biswas Garshan there from Kathmandu.
Thank you very much.
And that is our show for this week. Get in touch with us by tweeting me at Kim Vanell, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or you can drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. There's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on. And that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Kim Vanell. From the whole team here in Doha, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.